This is Addiction Medicine Journal Club. I'm Dr. John Keenan.
And I'm Dr. Sonia Del Tredici.
We believe that addiction is a disease that can be treated, and we want to help you stay up to date with the latest research that you can use in your addiction medicine practice. You can get Category 1 CME for listening to this podcast through MyCares and Michigan State University. The links are in the show notes. This week, we'll be discussing an article on benzodiazepine prescribing and the risk of subsequent drug overdose. How are you doing tonight, Sonia?
I'm doing really well. How are you doing, John?
Good. Just coming back from my kids' gymnastics practice, so it's very exciting.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
We have a milestone here because my older son is away at college this year, and my younger son just left on a week-long school trip, and so there are no kids in the house, and there's nobody to drive anywhere. It's pretty amazing.
Wow.
You'll get there someday.
How does that make you feel, though? I feel like that might be kind of a sad moment.
I have no more purpose after 7 p.m. I don't need to drive anyone anywhere.
Is it freedom, or do you feel like lack of isolation and loneliness or emptiness?
Well, I'm spending the evening with you, so, you know.
Okay. And your husband's at choir practice and having a drink afterwards, being wholesome for the two of us.
Exactly. He went out.
That's awesome. So what's new, or what's in your mind in addiction medicine news this week?
Well, I wanted to share an article in the popular press, and you may have seen this. I mean, a lot of our listeners may have seen it. It's being passed around a lot in addiction medicine circles. It's in Stat News, and they're doing a whole series called The War on Recovery about all the different ways people with opioid use disorder are denied access to methadone and buprenorphine. So part one was published, and it was very long, but very vivid about all the ways in which people with opioid use disorder are discouraged from taking medications. Everything from stigma to, you know, policies in rehabs and jails to, you know, policies from Narcotics Anonymous. You know, despite the fact that methadone and buprenorphine are safe, they're effective, there's just a lot of ways their use is actually discouraged. And stigma makes patients turn to them as a last resort rather than the first line treatment. I mean, a lot of stuff we've seen shows that the longer you use opioids, the higher your risk of death, the higher your risk of blowing up your life. So you really want to stop using them as soon as possible. So really, people should be given the most effective treatment first. They shouldn't turn to the most effective treatment last after all these other things have failed. But still, a lot of people treat medication as a last resort, not as a first line treatment. So again, the article series is called The War on Recovery. It's in Stat News. Have you seen this, John?
Yeah, they sent it out. I haven't read it as in detail as you. Certainly, it's on my list of things to look over.
Yeah, I just really wanted to share it because if you are listening to this podcast and you're not an addiction medicine provider, or you have friends in the community or lay people who would be interested, this is a great article to send to them so they can kind of understand some of the challenges that addiction medicine faces as we try to treat people. How about you, John? Anything struck you in addiction medicine news this week?
I saw this article kind of in the news feed that came up. It's from Scientific America. It's called Against Medical Advice, Another Deadly Consequence of Our Opioid Epidemic. And basically, it was an op-ed piece. And one thing they kind of referred to is about, you know, against medical advice, the new, more politically correct term is patient-directed discharge that we kind of have started to utilize more. We look at like a general population of people in the hospital, it's about 1%. And it's actually not surprisingly substantially higher in our patients with addiction. But they talk about this JAMA article that recently came out talking about patients with opioid use disorder, which do have the highest AMA rate in the hospital, and how actually from 2016 to 2020, that rate has actually risen. It's gone from 9% to 17% in this study. And I was actually kind of surprised about this because I would think that if anything, with all the different ways we're trying to kind of embrace this population at a systems level, at most hospital systems, the fact that we're doing the opposite and more people are leaving without getting the care that they require, that's kind of a big failure. And I don't have a great reason for why those numbers would be rising.
I just think with people using fentanyl, opioid withdrawal is just incredibly painful and unpleasant and difficult. And it starts so much quicker. And the sort of, you know, 0.1 milligrams of clonidine or a little bit of gabapentin is really not doing it for people. So unless you get a lot of buprenorphine or methadone, people are just super uncomfortable. Maybe more so than before. That's a guess. I don't know.
I mean, that's one theory. I just feel like you know, looking at, we've changed, right? As healthcare, we've changed. Most systems that I'm aware of, they have protocols for addressing withdrawal using agonist or partial agonist medication. You know, bridging people to treatment is both the right thing to do, but also incredibly cost effective and utilizes resources well. Many systems have things in place for this. You know, I'm not that old of a doc, although I feel older every day. I remember, like, when I was a medical student, you know, the tendings, we got to hold the line. You know, this patient's a drug user. We're not going to give them more than X, Y, or Z. And then we kind of embrace them with a treatment protocol to try to keep them feeling comfortable with opioids or opioid agonists in many instances. And it's kind of disheartening with all that work we've done and how much we've evolved that we're still not getting the outcomes that we wish.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree. You know, I think we're so all about, you know, getting people discharged early and quick. We forget that if people leave against medical advice before they're supposed to, they it means they haven't received the right treatment. And I admit, who wants to stay in the hospital? Like, nobody. Nobody wants to be in the hospital. But if you're really sick, especially a lot of our people are really sick, you should stay. And you should feel comfortable staying. And you should feel good that you're staying so you can get treatment.
Yeah. And this is somewhat biased from my opinion as a hospital provider, but I feel like so many patients I have in the hospital, they're kind of in the hospital for really social reasons, or they're older at their really baseline, just unable to take care of themselves at home. And then we have these people with these horrible illnesses, endocarditis, epidural abscess, these raging necrotizing fasciitis. They just like leave AMA and, you know, have poor outcomes. It's heartbreaking.
Well, I'll definitely put the links in the show notes for those as well. So are you ready to hear about this article?
Yeah, let's hear about it.
So this article has caused a lot of thoughts in my mind about benzodiazepines. So it's called Drug Overdose Risk with Benzodiazepine Treatment in Young Adults, Comparative Analysis in Privately and Publicly Insured Individuals. And it was published in the journal Addiction in 2023. So, John, I'm going to start with some background. Benzodiazepines, they're a class of medication used to treat anxiety and depression, and they are highly habit-forming even after relatively short use, meaning that you have withdrawal if you stop them. They're very commonly implicated in overdose deaths, especially when combined with opioids, and there is a black box warning regarding co-prescription of opioids and benzodiazepines. In 2021, there were 12,500 overdose deaths in the U.S. that involved a benzodiazepine. And about 1,000 of them involved benzodiazepine alone. So that's about 10% of the overall drug overdose deaths in the U.S. About 10% of them involved a benzodiazepine. And a minority of those, only about 1,000, involved a benzodiazepine alone. So usually the benzodiazepine was combined with something else. While overdose death is one of the more feared harms from benzodiazepines, many patients do feel that they have been permanently changed by their exposure, even if they took them as prescribed. There are a lot of first-person testimonials out there, and I've heard this from my patients, and I've even heard this from some coworkers, that they have never been the same after they took benzodiazepines. So they're very potent psychoactive drugs. Despite our knowledge of the risks, benzodiazepines continue to be prescribed very frequently. Patients request them, and clinicians seem eager to comply with those requests. So I ran a report from St. Max's electronic medical record. Overall, in our health system, there were 116,000 plus outpatient prescriptions for benzodiazepines written over the previous year. And of our patients on chronic opioids, so opioids for longer than 90 days, 24% of those patients are also on a benzodiazepine. So as a health system, St. Max's is not kind of withholding benzodiazepines at all. So we talk about overdose risks in people who take benzodiazepines, and many of those are taking them non-medically, meaning purchasing them illicitly. Very little is known about overdose risk of people taking initial prescribed benzodiazepines, especially young people, which is where they often start. So many patients who take long-term benzodiazepines are older, and they're very stable on low chronic doses, and they're not necessarily representative of people who take them for the first time. So this study looked at young people with a new diagnosis of anxiety and depression who are being prescribed either benzodiazepines or SSRIs for the first time, so sort of new users, which is not who our standard benzodiazepine-using patients are. So John, before we jump into this article, what's been your experience with prescribing and maybe even deprescribing benzodiazepines?
I think I said this in the journal club. I think I prescribed way more of these than I wish I did. I feel like I'm often kind of boxed into prescribing them between patients that are come to me as new patients, having been on them for long periods of time. Even older patients, like de-prescribing them is really quite challenging. Like the akathisia, the anxiety, it really is quite persistent. And so all of a sudden, you know, you might get them off the benzo, but now you have a 90-year-old woman with a blood pressure of 190 over 120 calling in all the time because they feel bad and they're jittery and, you know, they don't feel quite right. And honestly, in some regards, I feel like benzodiazepine prescribing is a surrogate marker of lack of other resources. I feel like I work in an area that's relatively, I don't want to be inflammatory about this, but like I don't have immediate access to a lot of behavioral health resources. I have a 6 to 12 month wait time for psychiatry, counseling services. I have people on the wait list for counseling for over 6 months. So like I don't have anything to offer patients today except for this. And often once you kind of start down that pathway, people really like the way you feel on it, right? The pharmacokinetics or is very similar to that of a glass of alcohol.
Right. Well, and we might have been a little harsh on you in our live journal club, but I have to say that the psychiatrists agree with you. I was doing a little research as I prepared for this, and there's a recent editorial in, I think, Journal Psychiatry saying that we need to like just chill about benzodiazepines. That they're not that bad. The data is weak and they're very, very effective for a lot of people. And I also found a study, which maybe we'll present. You know how we did those studies showing that if you stopped people's chronic long-term opioids, you had higher risks of suicide and overdose?
Mm-hmm.
Same thing for benzodiazepines.
I saw that study, yeah.
So, you know, patients who are stable on long-term chronic benzodiazepines, they may have worse outcomes if you try to stop them.
Yeah, I don't love prescribing them, but you're right. I did kind of play devil's advocate during that.
Yeah, somebody's got to do it, right? So let's talk about the clinical question. So this was a large database prospective cohort study asking whether a new prescription of benzodiazepines or benzodiazepines plus SSRI is associated with more drug poisonings, which is another way of saying overdoses, than a prescription for an SSRI alone in young people with anxiety or depression. Who was in this study? It included young people age 18 to 29. They had to be insured because this was an insurance database study, either public or private insurance. They had to have a depression or anxiety, and they were newly initiating medication with either SSRI, benzodiazepine, or benzodiazepine plus SSRI, meaning they had no scripts in the previous year, and then they got one of these three types of treatment. And this was done between 2006 and 2018. They excluded people, basically only people for whom it would be contraindicated to take any of the study medications, so seizure disorder or any other contraindication to SSRIs or benzodiazepines. Who were these people? So the data came from the MarketScan database, which is a privately insured, private insurance database, and it covers people in the entire United States. And then also data from Medicaid, which were our publicly insured patients. And this was data from 28 states where it was available. There were tons of tables in this article. The demographic table, which is table one in the article, took up 2.5 pages. So I'm just going to include some highlights. So in this study, about 35% of the patients who had private insurance were male, and about 20%-ish in the publicly insured group were male, meaning about 80% were female in the publicly insured group. In terms of anxiety and depression, about 80% of the people who got a benzodiazepine had a diagnosis of anxiety, going down to about 60% of people who got an SSRI had a diagnosis of anxiety. In terms of depression, it went the other way. About 25% of the people who got a benzodiazepine had a diagnosis of depression. About 55% of those who got an SSRI had a diagnosis of depression. And it went in the same way in the publicly insured patients, although the numbers were a little different. Also interesting was the prevalence of opioid use disorder. So in our private insurance, you know, about 1.8% of the patients who got benzodiazepines had an opioid use disorder. And what was kind of disheartening to me was that patients who had an opioid use disorder or had an opioid prescription were more likely to receive benzodiazepines than those who did not. In our public database, 7.5% of the patients who received benzodiazepine had an opioid use disorder, whereas only 6.2% of those who received an SSRI had an opioid use disorder. So the people who got benzos were more likely to have an opioid use disorder, despite the black box warning against that combination. Of the patients who got a benzo in our publicly insured population, 26% had an active opioid prescription as well. And they were more likely to have an opioid prescription than patients who got an SSRI. So that was a little bit depressing. The harmful event was initiation of benzodiazepines or benzodiazepines plus SSRI, and it was compared to the initiation of an SSRI alone. And the outcomes were primarily drug overdose treated in the ED or hospital within 6 months of treatment initiation. This did exclude fatal overdoses where the person died in the community and was never treated in a hospital or emergency room. They also looked at drug overdose intent, meaning a suicide versus an accidental overdose, and they looked at benzodiazepine-related overdoses and all drug overdoses. They also looked at confounding factors, so age, sex, anxiety, depression, other comorbid psychiatric diagnoses, prescription psychotropics, claims for psychotherapy, other diagnoses, other medications, provider contact, ED visits, geographic regions. They really tried to adjust for some of these confounders. I can't say how successful they were, but they certainly tried. And they pre-specified some subgroups. So they looked at the subgroup of patients who had a recent opioid prescription and also looked at people who had a diagnosis of substance use disorder other than tobacco in the previous year. So just to summarize the clinical question one more time, the official clinical question is, in young people with anxiety or depression who are receiving a new prescription for the first time, is there more drug overdose associated with benzodiazepines, benzodiazepines plus SSRIs, or SSRIs alone? So, John, what did you think of the clinical question?
I thought it was interesting. You know, the one thing that surprised me about this, I guess, two things. One is, you know, the indication of depression for benzodiazepines, I feel like I don't see that routinely used as a medication for that. So I was surprised how frequently that was used as an adjunct for that condition. And then I was also kind of surprised by the amount of patients that were just in the benzodiazepine group that weren't also getting an SSRI. It's surprising. I see often the most compelling indication for these is kind of like a bridge during that 4 to 6 week period of time of initiation. So I was surprised by those two things.
I don't think I start benzos on new patients who present with anxiety or depression. I mean, we talked about earlier the conflict of, you know, what to do with patients who are on chronic benzodiazepines for the last 20 years. Can you stop them or not? That's a very complicated question. It's just like the opioids, but I do not start benzodiazepines if someone comes in and says they have depression or anxiety and they're not on any meds. I definitely don't reach for benzodiazepines, especially for depression.
Yeah, I never prescribed for depression.
Well, actually, before I talk about validity, although I do see it because, of course, there's this concept that you should take a benzodiazepine if you're faced with a traumatic event, like a reactive depression. So, you know, you're whatever, you have a death in the family or some crisis, and you just need a benzodiazepine to get through that crisis. Like, I see that. I don't do it, but I see people giving Ativan, you know, lorazepam or alprazolam in wake of a trauma, which I don't think is necessarily correct, but I see that indication, and depression would be the diagnosis. All right, let's talk about validity. So I think it's a valid trial. Some strengths. It was large, very, very large, hundreds of thousands of people. They had detailed prescription data, so they knew every drug you took over the course of this study. The follow-up of 6 months I thought was long enough, although longer might have been better, but I think 6 months was good. They looked at overdoses for the whole 6 months, even if prescriptions were not continued for that time, since medications may have been stockpiled or exposure to benzodiazepines may have led to illicit use. I thought the outcome was relevant, which is, again, drug overdose. They did some sensitivity analyses, so they tried to exclude people with a different antidepressant prescription, excluded people with antipsychotic prescriptions, excluded people who had an overdose in the previous year, excluded people with panic disorder who might be more likely to get a benzodiazepine. So they tried to do a bunch of sensitivity analyses. So I appreciate that. And then they adjusted and trimmed their estimates to try to take into account the confounders and predictors of overdose, as well as some of these outliers. And that leads us to the biggest limitation of this study, which is that the groups are different at baseline. You know, various unmeasured confounders contribute to a clinician's decision whether or not to prescribe benzodiazepines, and patients may have very different prior experiences with benzodiazepines. So those who have a positive experience might request it, especially if they have an experience through illicit use. And I really do find that, like, my patients who have opioid use disorder also have a big positive effect from benzodiazepines. They find a big benefit from benzodiazepines. So they might ask their doctor for benzos in a situation where they have an acute episode of depression. So I just feel that's a huge limitation to this study. It's not randomized. A few other limitations were that no additional benefits or harms of benzodiazepines were measured. So we can't say if the benzodiazepines helped. So we can't really weigh risks versus benefits. It wasn't blinded, of course. And finally, causation. This goes along with the confounding, but causation is plausible, but it's not definitive. So there's no evidence that your prescribed benzodiazepine was involved in a benzodiazepine-related death 6 months later, or related overdose 6 months later, or any drug overdose 6 months later. You can't prove causation. They didn't include fatal overdoses outside the hospital. And finally, and this is true for a lot of our research, data is from emergency department and hospital diagnosis codes, and those can be inaccurate. And they include both serious and less serious types of opioid poisonings, for example, constipation that might require an enema versus overdose where you almost died, are both considered opioid poisonings or overdoses and might both be counted together. So, John, do you think this was a valid trial?
I mean, I think definitely it's a valid trial. It's like a large database collection. You're right. There's a lot of in between as to what happens, but I think that you can't really argue with that there's an association between these prescribing habits and then like a pretty validated outcome, you know, these toxicosyndromes or poisoning events that are kind of documented with encounters. So it's probably, if anything, underestimating the true effect of these medications, right?
Yeah, it's very cut and dried. You know, it doesn't include a lot of subjective information, which is good. So results, you know, this paper had so much data about benzodiazepine prescriptions in this population. It described which benzodiazepines were used for how long, which subgroups, which diagnoses in a very granular level. I think it must have been written by a psychiatrist. And I encourage anyone who's interested to look at any of the data tables in this paper. You know, they listed out all the different anxiety diagnoses. And I'll just, you know, out myself here as a general internist. I always just put anxiety. There's like five different anxiety diagnoses. I always just put anxiety. I don't really sort out, is it panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, social anxiety disorder? I don't know. Do you?
There's no HCC with anxiety, Sonia. Are you kidding me? You're going to get some coding modules assigned to you tomorrow.
I'm leaving all those HCC diagnoses on the table.
You are.
But if you want to know about how benzodiazepines are prescribed to this population, definitely take a look at this paper. In terms of our primary result, the adjusted hazard ratios of drug overdose for benzodiazepine versus SSRI treatment was 1.36 for privately insured patients and 1.59 for publicly insured young adults. So more drug overdoses in people who got benzodiazepines alone compared to SSRIs alone. If you look at benzodiazepines plus SSRIs compared to SSRIs alone, again, there was a higher rate of drug overdose. The hazard ratio was 1.99 in private patients and 1.98 in publicly insured patients. So, you know, if we want to talk some numbers, the incidence of drug poisoning, let's just say there's a lot of different categories here. I don't want to read off all the numbers because that will just like bore everybody. But just to give you a general sense of what we're talking about here, let's say the lowest incidence, and look at my data table. So in patients who received SSRIs alone, privately insured patients, the rate of drug poisoning at 6 months was 0.65%. So a little more than 0.5% had a drug poisoning at 6 months in the group that got SSRIs alone. The group with the highest rate of drug poisonings were publicly insured patients who received both benzodiazepines and SSRIs, and they had a 2.08% rate of drug poisoning, so almost four times higher than the lowest incidence group. So not insignificant. I mean, 2% of patients receiving a drug poisoning, I mean, that's a lot of people, of the people who got a benzo plus SSRI. And I thought this was interesting. Getting a benzo plus SSRI was higher risk than getting a benzodiazepine alone. And I don't know why that is. I could make some guesses, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, but the confidence intervals overlap, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, right, it's interesting. The numbers themselves are interesting, but there is an overlap there, right?
Yeah. I mean, there is. And they're not super different. It's sort of rare and slightly less rare event. But I don't know. I feel like that result was the confidence interval. Okay, fine. Statistics, confidence intervals overlap.
Now, the reason I'm saying that is because I got called out on that on a previous episode.
That's why we do this, you know? Always learning. Always learning.
But you're right. The numbers are appalling if you ignore the statistics.
Oh my God. So that's sort of the main result. You know, the second main result was benzodiazepine-associated drug poisonings, which of course are much higher in patients who received benzodiazepines. So I'll give an example. In our privately insured patients, those who got a benzodiazepine had a 0.39% incidence of benzodiazepine poisoning, and those who received an SSRI had a 0.08% chance of benzodiazepine poisoning. So the hazard ratio was almost 5, comparing benzos alone to SSRIs alone. In our publicly insured patients and our privately insured patients, if you compare SSRI to benzo plus SSRI, the hazard ratio is almost 7, 6.5 or 7 for rate of benzodiazepine overdose, which I guess isn't surprising. Like, I think patients who get a benzo would have a higher rate of benzodiazepine overdose, but it really does make you think that those initial prescriptions are connected to subsequent poisonings. It's not just a coincidence or just the people who already have a problem end up getting prescribed benzodiazepines. Another interesting fact, I know it's a lot of numbers, but there was a much higher overdose incidence among youth with a substance use disorder or an opioid prescription than those without. And I feel that that's, you know, not surprising, but just to sort of put it out there. So I'm going to summarize the results. Basically, among young adults in the United States who are initiating benzodiazepines for anxiety and depression alone or simultaneously with an SSRI, it appears that there's an increased risk of medically treated drug overdose compared to an SSRI alone. These associations were observed in privately and publicly insured individuals and in all pre-specified subgroups. The effect was strongest in intentional overdoses, meaning suicides, and there was also a strong association between receiving a prescription for benzodiazepine and having opioid use disorder and receiving prescription opioids. So that's the bottom line. So, John, what did you think of the results? Were you surprised by them?
Not particularly, right? I mean, I think that this is something that we kind of continue to go over and over again about the co-prescribing risks with these medications. And I think that especially kind of in the era where a lot of people are on like agonist type medications, although this article didn't look at it, I think knowing what co-prescribed medications are increasing risk is really important, right?
Right. Well, it's just, we show it over and over in all these different populations that receiving a prescription for opioids and in this study, benzodiazepines raises your risk of developing or having opioid use disorder or having an overdose in the future. And it's not clear what the connection is, but the association, I mean, I haven't read a paper yet that said you have a lower risk of drug overdose if you receive a prescription for opioids, you know? Haven't seen that data. So are these results going to change my practice? They might, maybe. I don't know. The patients are similar to mine. I do see young people with anxiety and depression. In terms of risk versus benefits, the benefits to patients of benzodiazepines were not specified, but previous studies do show short-term benefits, especially with anxiety and depression. Risks to patients, they talked about drug poisonings, especially intentional overdose or suicide, but other clinically relevant harms like dependence, sedation, car accidents, I don't know, jail time, all kinds of risks of benzodiazepines, they were not considered. And so I tried to calculate the number needed to harm, meaning how many people would you need to give a benzodiazepine to, add on a benzodiazepine to cause a drug poisoning. So in my calculation, if you added a benzo to the SSRI, one in 164 people you did that for would have a drug overdose, and one in 204 people would have a benzodiazepine overdose. Among publicly insured patients, adding a benzodiazepine to the SSRI leads to one in 110 people having a drug overdose and one in 169 people having a benzodiazepine overdose. So the risk exists, but it's not large. You'd have to treat over 100 patients with benzodiazepines to lead to one benzodiazepine poisoning. And most of these were not fatal poisonings. It's not even clear what the poisoning consisted of. So the risk does seem relatively low. So bottom line, I probably still will not be initiating benzodiazepines for anxiety and depression. I don't do it now, and this study has not convinced me to do it in the future. But if I do have a patient who needs them, I don't think I will be unduly worried that they're taking a toxic medication. But given the risk of subsequent drug poisoning, especially in patients with opioid use disorder, I would be particularly cautious in that subgroup. So what about you, John? Did this article change your thinking on benzodiazepines at all?
Not really. right? I feel like I don't like to prescribe them to begin with. Although I, as we went through in the journal club, I think I prescribe it more than the other people at the journal club. I often feel like these medicines come into play when there's like a lack of other options, right? And I think we have good clinical control trials about like, you know, SSRIs and depression or atypical antipsychotics or mood stabilizers and bipolar disorder. But I feel like the truth is a lot of times I'm using these medications, as I've shared, they're kind of reactionary issues. So I can think of one lately, a mom whose son wandered into a storm drain and drowned, and she's young and she's on multiple psychotropics and she's crying every day for 6-7 months. And I put her on Klonopin to try to make that more tolerable. And, you know, maybe that's not the most evidence-based recommendation, but it's got to the point where you're just out of options to try to help someone. Certainly there was a fair amount of counseling. Like the risk is real. Like patients need to be aware of that. And sometimes actually people will hear the risk and they'll tell me, you know what, never mind, I'm okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I always just feel bad that if we permanently change someone's brain chemistry and then they're kind of stuck with it forever. I mean, I feel like I have a bunch of patients who felt like they're never the same after they stopped their benzodiazepines. And you might say, why bother stopping? I'm just continuing them forever. But, you know, people don't always want to do that.
Yeah, I've seen articles about like symptoms like, you know, after discontinuation, like akathisia, particularly like lasts more than 12 months after discontinuation. And, you know, there is harm with it. I just don't have another option. And, you know, it's tough when people keep coming in for help and they're suffering.
Yeah, it's true. And if this helps them and they're willing to accept the risk, maybe that's fine. You know, who are we to deny it?
Yeah.
Famous last words, right?
No, and then sometimes I think about it, I'm like, you know, aren't we all in some regard a little bit of a hospice patient? This is life's a terminal condition. You're trying to alleviate suffering.
That is true. That's your job, right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I really was happy to review this article. I got a lot out of reading about benzodiazepines.
Well, we have a little bit of talk back for some previous episodes. We had a good comment about episode 24 from a sister addiction medicine podcast. Casey Grover here from the Addiction Medicine Made Easy podcast. I changed the name from Addiction in Emergency Medicine and Acute Care podcast. So there's been a name change there for anyone else. It's a great podcast. I just listened to the Smoking Cessation and Mortality podcast. I usually frame the hazard of smoking with this statistic. Each cigarette reduces your life by 11 minutes. Not sure if either of you ever heard of that stat, but I use that all the time for education and smoking and talking points to patients about quitting. Just wanted to share. Have you heard that stat particularly, Sonia?
No, I've never said that each cigarette reduces your life by 11 minutes, but I kind of want to.
Yeah, I like that as well. I've heard that in reference. I think I've heard other ones like 10 minutes, but 11 minutes. I think it depends upon, but I think that sometimes that's a very real number for patients.
Yeah.
Or maybe you could phrase it in packs and even make it more impactful by 2 hours or 2.5. Each pack is 2.5 hours of your life going out the door.
Each carton is like 14 hours.
Yeah. Each pallet, two years of your life. Well, thank you for listening to the Addiction Medicine Journal Club. The best part of any journal club is the conversation, and we want to hear what you have to say. To have your opinions about the articles included in a future episode, send us your comments on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Spotify, email, or join our Facebook group. The links are in the show notes. Original theme music was composed and performed by Benjamin Kennedy, audio edited by Aaron McHugh. CME support from MyCares, produced by Dr. Patrick Beeman at Ars Longa Media. Addiction Medicine Journal Club is intended for educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views expressed here are our own and do not necessarily reflect those of our employers or the authors of the articles we review. All patient information has been modified to protect their identities. Thank you for being part of the conversation. Have a great day.